This is the Medicast, July 13th, 2009.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medicast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's show. We've got a lot going on this week, so I'm going to be jumping right in here. But I wanted to remind all of you that you can always find out more information, links to all the news items, as well as follow-up links for any of the tips and medications we cover here, all available for you over at the Medicast blog. And you can get there by going to medicast.com/blog. Of course, the main Medicast site at medicast.com has links to all of our other programs, such as The Nursing Show, Medicast News, and others. So you'll want to make sure you follow up there as well. But in the EMT podcast category over at the Medicast blog, you'll find all of the show notes for every episode of the Medicast. And that's all available for you over there. Great way to follow up on any of the information you find here. Don't forget, if you have any comments, suggestions, or corrections, you can always leave those with us by email. Send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com or call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342. 941-30-MEDIC is your way to get through to the Medicast and leave your voicemail message. Don't forget at the very end to leave your email address. I'll trim it off if I play it on the show, but if I need to follow up for additional information or want to get in touch with you directly, it's a great way to do that and leave that at the end, and then I'll cut it off so that it doesn't go out over the whole show. I know there's a lot of brand new listeners out there, people getting ready to start their EMT or paramedic student programs, and I just want to welcome you especially. There's a lot of information available here on the show, in the past episodes, and over at the Medicast site, including information available for you there specifically for students and tips. So take advantage of those resources. A lot of them are free, and I want to make sure that you become the best and most successful EMS student you can be. So, hey, you can join us out on the street. It's a great way to get information out there and get it to you via this podcast, but you can also spread the word as well. So if you like something you hear on the show, don't forget to spread the word and let other folks hear about it. Let's get into the listener email, and I got an email in from listener Jesse, who was listening to a recent episode talking about capnography as a potential tip and trick of the week, and wanted to let me know about a resource that he found very useful. EMScapnography.blogspot.com has a great set of resources, according to Jesse, including identification of bronchospasm, verification of respirations, and a lot more. And, you know, capnography is an amazing tool that I think is underutilized to a great extent in the EMS setting, primarily because we don't have all of the tools that go along with capnography to use it. A lot of us just see it as a device to verify tube placement, but it has so many more ramifications and gives us the ability to better assess respiratory patients, to better follow patient tracking and trending through looking at how well they are engaging in gas exchange and their respiratory status in general. So I would urge you to check out this resource. Again, that's emscapnography.blogspot.com. And I will send Jesse an email back and thank him for this great link. You can also find some other information in a lot of different resources at very many sites. Just search capnography EMS and you should be able to find a lot of other resources. And just because we have this doesn't mean that I'm not going to be looking into capnography values in a future episode. I also heard in from listener Daniel. He was checking in after our live call a week or so ago about the EMS boot camp program coming up. And one of the things I talked about during that live cast was a discussion on the fact that I'm looking for a couple of interns here for the MedicCast. The internship is going to be an opportunity for you to add something cool to your resume. You'd be listed as a producer for the show, get that internship on your resume. You'd be responsible for helping to do some research and write some short articles. And so if you are interested in checking out the internship and finding out a little bit more about it and would like to do so, we're looking for somebody, that a couple of people that can maybe spend 2 hours or so a week. It wouldn't be a lot of time. We're not going to compensate you with any money directly. I can't really afford to do that. But if you are a student and would like to become an intern, I can give you access to a lot of our study aid resources for free. So if that would be something you'd be interested in, and perhaps a MedicCast Extra membership, get in touch with me. Send me an email to podmedic@mac.com. And in that email, put internship in the subject line. And I will get back to you with what I'm looking for. Generally, I'm going to ask you to write a brief article on a recent EMS news item and see how that article looks. And I'll probably select the 3 or 4 best articles that I get in. And that'll be primarily what you're going to do. You're going to help me do some research on news articles and help me out with some stuff on the website. And it won't require any web programming. If you can use a word processor, you can do what I need to do. So check in with me if you're interested. Again, podmedic@mac.com and put internship in the subject line. And Daniel, I'll be getting back to you very shortly with some of the information, and you can start following up as well. I've had a lot of listeners contacting me and friending me up over at Facebook and following me over at Twitter. And so I just wanted to just respond back to all of you and say thanks for doing so. And I hope you enjoy following up on what's going on over on those sites. It's always fun to participate in that social media community. And so I urge you to keep in touch with me there as well, by email or any other way. I always We'll post up the podcast information there as well as links. And you can always make comments on the links over at Facebook, or, you know, give the old thumbs up saying you like the recent episode. It's always a help. And it also helps spread the word among the community that you bring into the social media networks. So I want to thank all of you that have done that recently. If you would like to follow me on Twitter or friend me up on Facebook, you can find me pretty easily. Twitter.com/podmedic or Facebook.com/podmedic, PODMEDIC, and we will get squared away. I'll confirm your friendship as quickly as I can, and it's always great to have more in the community over there. Time now for this week's look at the EMS news, and I'm going to lead off with a story I found over at the McCook Gazette.com, and this particular item is from the McCook, Nebraska newspaper, and it's looking at whether we should charge more for bariatric patients, for those obese patients. Why? Well, because some services are instituting special bariatric units that require expensive equipment, require additional staffing. You know, we should not be lifting an obese patient with just 2 providers. The number one cause of injury and loss of employees to the EMS industry and other healthcare services: back injuries. Why? Because of poor lifting techniques and because of the expectation that we're going to lift more than we are really capable of safely lifting. So, of course, my opinion is we should charge extra for obese ambulance patients. They require additional staffing. They require multiple providers to come in on the lift. They require specialized equipment that's more expensive. It's no different than having a patient with an additional medical issue that has to require additional medical attention and additional billing. You know, if you have a patient that is diabetic and is in the hospital, they have to be seen by a specialist in some cases. And when that specialist comes, it isn't included in the general bill for their other problem they're in for. Those referrals are charged at an additional rate. It's no different. So I definitely think that obese ambulance patients should be covered under a higher charge, whether it's an additional charge or some additional fee associated with patients over, let's say, 300 pounds. So what do you think? Do you think we should be charging more for these patients? I mean, hey, it's your backs that they're going to be ripping up if you have to lift them alone with just you and your partner. So what are we doing for dealing with these patients as we run into more and more of them in the field? Certainly, it seems to me to make sense, but I'd like to hear back from you. So this is a great idea for you guys to comment in on the voicemail line or via email. Email to podmedic@mac.com or the voicemail line 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Next up in the news, we're going to revisit again the Oklahoma Highway Patrol incident where a paramedic was stopped and arrested following an incident where they had a patient on board and apparently didn't yield fast enough for an Oklahoma Highway Patrolman for his liking. He pulled the ambulance over and would not release them to continue on to the hospital despite being told numerous times they had a patient on board, and then began to initiate the arrest of the paramedic in charge of patient care. If you haven't seen this, there's a link in the show notes. You can watch the video. It's pretty disturbing. What has come out, if you haven't been following this, is of course that the paramedic did the right thing, it seems. He has not been under any kind of investigation. He seems pretty level-headed and has time and again said that this is an isolated incident, that his experience with Oklahoma Highway Patrol has always been professional with their conduct towards him and others. But this incident has reflected back on the Oklahoma Highway Patrol. They were slow to release the dashboard camera video. When that camera video was released, it backed up the paramedic's statement that he did not escalate the situation, but that the trooper escalated the situation. So the Oklahoma Highway Patrol has put him on administrative leave and has been investigating. So they're still investigating. Some reports have said that this trooper may have been fired from a previous job as a police officer for complaints of bullying behavior, and that certainly would coincide with what we've seen in the videos, the multiple videos that we have seen online. But we're going to wait and have them resolve this and figure out what they're doing. But, you know, they're continuing to investigate. What the heck are they investigating? All the information is out there. Everything has been turned in. It seems to me that this is a pretty cut and dried situation. There was really no excuse to hinder an ambulance in the middle of a patient transport just for a traffic violation, especially when the ambulance provider said that we're going to the X hospital, please come, you can arrest us after we drop our patient off. Certainly there was no need to continue the altercation on the side of the road. And it seems that the investigation of this trooper is backing that up. Moving right along, you know, we talk about mass casualty incidents all the time with our colleagues. I talk about it here on the show. I talk about preparedness, about thinking about what's in your region and thinking about how you would react. I mean, it's that pre-planning, even if it's pre-planning in your brain, that can go a long way to how you handle a situation. Well, remember, everybody has different areas and there's different things in your area. What if you had a major theme park in your area, such as, I don't know, Walt Disney World? Well, in Florida, one of the Florida Disney World monorails late at night crashed into another monorail that was already at the station, killing the driver and causing some minor injuries to the seven passengers that were on board. Seems a pretty tragic situation all the way around. But, you know, this is something that makes you think. I mean, when you have something like an overhead mass transit unit, such as a monorail, what would you do if you had a crash or an incident that occurred in the middle of the monorail? If you were having to work at a high state up in the air where you had to bring in additional resources, what if you had a crash of a monorail where you had two trains colliding on this elevated track? How would you get the patients down from there safely? You can't use your typical triage tactics because where are you going to have the walking wounded walk to? These are kind of things that you need to think about. So there's a great article I found over at emsresponder.com kind of talking about one of the responders to the Disney monorail crash, talking about how they handled the situation. The monorail crash happened practically right in front of him. This individual was an EMT from West Palm Beach, was on vacation with his family 4th of July weekend when the monorail crash happened. He ran up to the track, saw the wreckage, and began to went to work. He tried to get a response out of the patient, the driver in the window, banging on the door, can you hear me? But didn't get any response from the driver. Then with another witness, they began to open the door to the front of the car and trying to get to the driver so they could get him out of the crushing mass of metal. But with no rescue equipment, they weren't able to do it. And as he looked around inside the cabin, really the crush injury was so severe that he really didn't believe that the patient had survived anyway. But they couldn't do anything with the rescue. But it just brings to mind, again, when you're in an unusual situation, look around you. You may be called upon to respond. So think about how you would respond. Look for things like an exit route if you're in a situation where you may need to seek shelter. Think about these things. And of course, if you work in an area with unusual workplaces like a theme park, amusement park, if you work in an area with a lot of industrial facilities around or things like that, think about how you would respond if there was a major incident at one of these locations, because each one presents unique problems, just as this particular monorail incident did. Finally, I'll wrap up with another story from EMSresponder.com. This is a story that was brought out of a military article written by Specialist Daryl Montgomery of the 172nd Infantry Brigade. And the Iraqi medical personnel are receiving a lot of their training from our highly trained specialist medics in our armed forces that are serving in Iraq. And we're really helping to put first responders and EMS providers in the field in that country. And, you know, this is one of those things that no matter how many different places and people I talk to from around the world about where they work and the types of things they deal with, I find time and again, EMS providers, EMTs, and paramedics, first responders on the ground, no matter where they are, no matter what type of equipment they operate with, we are really all essentially the same. We are there to serve our public. We are a bit of an adrenaline junkie, and we really want to do our best to help our patients. And it's heartening to see that we're passing on some of our knowledge and our information to move forward and help train these first responders at these centers in different parts of Iraq. Part of the Civil Affairs Provincial Reconstruction Team and the 172nd Infantry Support Battalion, these people are in their training for doctors, nurses, and paramedics to help them develop the ability to assess patients rapidly, to become really good first responders. They did simulated car accidents because in Iraq, about 90% of all hospital admissions are from car accidents. We had patients that in that situation that were exhibiting fractures, head and spine injuries. And so these responders are trained to really recognize these things and work in a different way than they might have learned to work in a hospital setting. Really good stuff. And I really, like I said, I'm heartened when I see these kinds of things because, you know, there's a lot of violence and bad things going on over there. But there are, in the midst of all of that horror and violence and bombs and everything else, there are EMS providers and ambulances out there trying to get the job done, trying to transport their patients and get them from the place of their injury or their illness and get them to the hospital so they can get some kind of definitive treatment. And we can't forget that whenever there's a situation like that going on, that, you know, most of the people are just folks like us. They're just trying to get the job done. They're trying to go home to their families. They're trying to do something good for their community. And, you know, that's no different than what we do here in the States or anywhere else you might be listening to this podcast. So kudos to them for their training. I'm proud to see that we're passing on our knowledge in this way. And I look forward to seeing more articles like this from other parts of the world, because it doesn't matter whether your ambulance is a motorcycle with a sidecar or even, you know, a bicycle with a tandem seat. I don't care. An ambulance is an ambulance is an ambulance. And it's something that, you know, we're providing care and transport for our patients so that they can do better and have better health overall. For the tip and trick of the week this week, I'm going to be talking about electrical burns. Now, we've talked about burns here on the show in the past, but I saw a bunch of articles recently on electrical injuries related to lightning strikes, and I thought it would be something that we've kind of specialized in. We'll take a look at specifically electrical burns. And I think that this is something that we don't run into that frequently, and is one of those topics that we probably should review more frequently than we already do. First of all, why do we call electrical injuries burns? Well, The reason is that just like a light bulb, a normal filament style light bulb, heats up as the electricity passing through the tungsten filament causes light and heat energy as well, because of the resistance of the electricity passing through it, the human body, while it does allow electricity to pass through it, to a certain extent, it is pretty much resistant to that. And as that resistance that causes extreme heat. So low voltages doesn't really cause any residual heat to the point that it causes a burn. You just feel a tingle. But in higher voltages and more high tension wires, lightning strikes and things like that, you will see increased burn injury related to the passage of the electricity through the tissues. And so this is what causes the burn. It is the heat of the resistance of the body to the electricity passing through it. And that's a key point to remember as well, is that the electricity passes through the body. It doesn't just touch a single point. So for instance, in a standard burn, a chemical burn even, you have a single location of the burn related to the proximity to the heat. If you were to have a burn injury to a hand, for instance, if let's say you were handling some, gasoline, and you had gloves on and a spark caught your glove on fire and you started to get a burn as you pulled the glove off and you got burns to your hand. You have burns isolated to your hands related to the direct application of heat to your hands. In an electrical injury, because the electricity passes through the body, what you can physically see on a normal assessment to the patient is not necessarily indicative of the level of burn injury to this patient. And you need to look for both an entrance and an exit point for that burn, especially in the very high voltage burns. You have your high tension wires, you have your lightning strikes. Usually there is an entry and an exit wound. And just much like a bullet travels through the body and tumbles and doesn't necessarily travel in a straight line, the same is true for the electricity. It may not go, in fact, it probably won't go in a straight line from point A to point B, being the entry and exit points. And so you have to really assume that there is a significant level of burn injury internally to the patient. Now, you might not think that this is as prevalent because you haven't run into an electrical burn in a while or maybe ever, but it is more prevalent than you might think. According to a couple of the resources I found, including CDC, Centers for Disease Control, and NIOSH, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, they have a great page on electrical safety, especially for electrical trades, people that are working around electricity on a regular basis. Electrocution is the third leading cause of work-related death among 16 and 17-year-olds, and this is after motor vehicle accidents and workplace homicide. Electrocution, it causes about 12% of all workplace deaths among young workers. So this is a significant source of injury, and if you think about it, electricity is everywhere. I mean, everything we have in our home is operated by electricity. You're listening to this podcast because of electricity. There are many, many opportunities for someone to make a poor choice or just a stupid mistake or just something accidentally to cause them to have an electrical burn. And that's if you discount things like lightning strikes. If you look at lightning safety statistics, you get into even more information. Lightning fatalities in 2008, there were 28 lightning fatalities in the United States in 2008. Doesn't seem like that many, but these are the fatalities. And so there were others that were injuries from near-miss strikes. I personally, my father-in-law was outside redirecting a downspout because water was running into the basement, and he was actually touching the aluminum downspout when a lightning strike, and we're not sure if it struck the house or somewhere nearby, but actually he sustained an electrical injury from that caused him to be a little unsteady and have some changes to his gait, his walking for a period of time until it resolved. And so this is something that can happen and cause minor injury. Imagine what could happen to someone with a pacemaker or some other implanted device or just somebody with a cardiac history. It could cause or precipitate a lethal arrhythmia. So these are things that we need to keep in mind. They're more prevalent and possible than we might ordinarily think. So you have an entry and an exit point for large electrical injuries or electrical burns, and it travels an unpredictable path within the body. This unpredictable path can follow certain predictable areas, but again, you don't necessarily know which direction it goes to get to the exit point. It will follow paths of least resistance along the way, so it's less likely to travel along bone or muscle, although it can. It is more likely to travel along blood vessels and the nervous system, so along nerves. I mean, heck, nerves are built to transmit electricity, right? So they're more easily transmitting. A very high voltage charge can, of course, travel across all of them and cause significant burns to all the tissues, whereas a lesser shock or jolt could cause more injuries to these other pathways, such as the nervous system and the blood vessels, vasculature. And so you could have problems with burns along an entire system of veins returning to the central core of the body. You might have an exit wound on the side of the body or the foot and an entry wound in one hand, and it could travel up across the shoulders, down through the abdomen, to the hips, across the hips, and down into the leg. You just don't know. It could zigzag any which way. So you could have significant burns. You could have, you know, burns that could approach 30, 40, 50% of the body, depending on where the burns traveled. And of course, you also have problems with the tissues. If it traveled through a certain organ, you could have a single organ be significantly damaged. And so this is something that you just can't predict just based upon what you're looking at. You can also have burns associated with electrical burns because of the flash burns where maybe clothing catches fire at the point of contact. So the electricity jumps from whatever you came in contact with it to across to the body, and the air itself superheated because its air also resists electricity, and that superheated air could set clothing on fire or set the external tissues on fire from the thermal burn. So you could also concomitantly have burns associated with what you would normally expect to see, second or third degree burns at the point of entry or around the point of entry. There are other common injuries associated with electrical burns, and you need to be thinking about these things. The consistent muscle contraction of a strong electrical jolt could cause fractures of the long bones. You would also may likely see something like rupture of the tympanic membranes, and the patient may not be able to hear you very well or at all because of this membrane rupture in the ears, and you would have difficulty communicating with them where their pain is, where what they were doing. So you're going to need to keep all of these other things in mind. There can be significant renal damage and also a release of electrolytes based on damage to the body's tissues, kind of like a crush injury. So you need to keep these things in mind and be prepared to treat these patients aggressively. I would definitely involve your local burn center on the med radio or however you get in contact with online medical control. When you have an electrical burn, because it's so difficult to estimate the burn surface area, it's difficult to apply something like the Parkland formula. The Parkland formula is the formula that says that patients who have burns need a lot of fluids to maintain their body tissues, and that fluid resuscitation has to be applied in the first 24 hours, half of it in the first 8 hours. And of course, that means we need to get fluid started too. And I would consult with the meds, with the physician on the other end of your med radio, and find out what they'd like you to do as far as starting an IV and giving them fluids according to your protocol. So these are things that you can apply, but you should be prepared to initiate anything that you would normally do for burns, because you're going to have burns at the entry and exit point. But again, respiratory support, O2 IV, oxygen, monitor is going to be very important because, of course, what runs on electricity in the body is all of our muscles, including the heart. And the musculature of the heart could be exhibiting problems. You may see arrhythmias that crop up in patients that didn't previously have them. You may see damage to something like an implanted defibrillator or pacemaker in a patient who has such a device. So it is very important to get a monitor on these patients so that you can monitor their cardiac status. Also, depending on the term that they were in contact with the electricity, they may have become apneic prior to your arrival, and they may require respiratory support. If the entry point is near the face, they may have airway burns associated with the flash heating of the air. All of these things need to be kept in mind, and you really need to take a good history from bystanders or, if possible, from the patient themselves to find out exactly what happened, what kind of electricity and electrical contact they had, so that you can pass that information on to medical control and get the best possible treatment options for these patients. There's a lot of good resources online, and I've provided the links to them in the show notes. I would also encourage you to look into a course like the PHTLS program, Pre-Hospital Trauma Life Support. PHTLS is a program that encompasses all kinds of traumatic injury, but there is a lot of good stuff in there about burns of various types, including electrical burns. And I would encourage you always to branch out and get more education. You're listening to this show, so I suspect that you're probably a type of person who would like to know more about these types of things. And these extra classes that are offered by various organizations are great ways to get an intensive lecture lesson on things like trauma and burns and stuff like that. Plus, you have a very knowledgeable staff teaching usually in those situations. And if you have a particular question, you can ask that question of the instructor. So I would look into maybe if one of those classes is being offered in your region. Again, follow up in the show notes with the links that I provided. There's information there on safety around lightning from the National Weather Service, also information on general electrical safety in the workplace, and an article over at emedicine.com on electrical burns. All of that available for you at medicast.com, and you'll find those links there. Or if you subscribe to the newsletter, you'll get it there as well. And that's going to wrap up this episode of the MedicCast. I want to remind everyone to check out MedicCast.com for all of the resources you'll find in the MedicCast blog linked there. Also, sign up for the MedicCast newsletter. It's a great way to get all of the show notes and links sent directly to your email box, along with other information and special opportunities that come along. I send that to you as well. And it's a great way to keep in touch with me here at the show. If you'd like to get back in touch with me, you can reach me here via the voicemail box at 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. You can also catch up with me via email at podmedic@mac.com, or just leave a comment over at the MedicCast blog. You'll find links at the bottom of every article there where you can comment on the articles and share your thoughts with the MedicCast community. Time to close out the show, and I'll wrap up with some PodSafe music from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. This is Brian Fitzpatrick and the Band of Brothers with his song, Hey Mary. If you like what you hear, you can get a hold of him and let him know you heard it here on the MedicCast. You can also purchase the song. There's a link in the show notes that will allow you to head right on over to iTunes and pick up the song or any of the songs from that artist. And it's a great way to support them. They provide their music free of charge to us here and on podcasts of various types. And it's always great to support these independent musical artists. That's it for me. I'll be back next week with another episode here on the MedicCast. And in the meantime, don't forget, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, reminding all of you to remember, scene safety, BSI.
Hey, Mary, is there anyone up there that wants to see me? Does anybody care and will they know me? Far beyond the shadow of this dream. Hey, Mary, is there anyone up there that wants to see me? Does anybody care and will they know? I've still got work to do here. My time is far from through here. Someday you'll see me when the clock strikes noon again. Hey, Mary, is there anyone up there that wants to see me? Does anybody care and do they know me? Far beyond the shadow of this dream. Are you free from these confines? Are you part of the divine? How is it to know? But I've still got songs to write here. I still got a light to light here. Someday you'll see me when the clock strikes noon again.
Shadow of this dream.